Following the panel discussion, the event was open to questions from the audience. The panel took 4 questions at a time, then responded to them. In the first round, they were asked about government surveillance, serious activism, and communication.
Well, I'm going to work backwards a little bit. So we started this with a question about what are concrete action steps, and I think that, I mean, one of the first concrete action steps that everybody here has done is just showing up tonight, right? Like, it's cold out, it's miserable, and you didn't stay home and wait for the webcast. You showed up, and I think that that's a big part of it, and I think that we just have to commit to showing up more and more and more. And that's the first concrete step. It doesn't have to be always the cause that you're the most passionate about, but if you show up, that makes the event more successful, and you know, you might actually learn something. So I start there, but the other quick comment that I want to make regarding really sort of a quiet theme that runs in a lot of these questions is that, you know, when we think about the surveillance state, and I appreciate the comment, you know, sort of calling for precision in language when we say something like the establishment is not serious. Of course there's a seriousness to it, and of course this is serious business. That's part of why we all showed up, right? Because we do know that there's a degree of seriousness here. But there's also a really high degree of fear in the left in this country, and there has been for a really long time. And we're afraid to say what we think, and we're afraid to say what we think because we feel like there's going to be a file put on us. We're afraid to say what we think because we might offend someone. We're afraid to say what we think because it's not popular, right? Or because it's going to label us as some sort of leftist. So I would say the second sort of major concrete action that we can take is to just sort of set that fear aside and be willing to speak up and be willing to be wrong, because that's part of it too, right? Sometimes you have to speak off the cuff and you might say something wrong. But also to sort of not be afraid to offend someone and not be afraid to be offended, right? So let's just start listening to each other and start talking to each other. So here's my full circle moment when I bring it back to the comment about going into communities where you might feel a little uncomfortable or where you don't feel like this is a politicized environment, and being open about your politics and wearing them on your sleeve and saying, this is what I think. And this is why I think it, and I think the other important key to that, of course, that is critical not to forget, is to then ask the question, what do you think, right? And so I think when we start doing that, and then if we pin it all together with this idea that we don't have to agree on everything all the time, that's really how we start building community and building dialogue. But those are my concrete steps. Show up and be less afraid.
Well, I appreciate the comment about the surveillance state, not just the Patriot Act, but the National Defense Authorization Act, and of course the fusion centers, which sounds just a freaky science fiction thing, where they vacuum clean information from your locality and bring it to these fusion centers, and then they burst it out, you know, to Washington, D.C., to some big computer which wants to know about every single traffic stop of everybody, et cetera. And then associated with that, of course, is the other side of surveillance, which is not just sucking in information, but going out there and finding vulnerable people to sort of target them, trigger them, make them say things that are wrong, you know, make them want to start plotting something which they don't really want to get involved in, and then arrest them and have this enormous panoply of media saying we've stopped a terrorist attack. Because at the same time as you have the surveillance state which watches you, you have the surveillance states that puts fear in you. You know, when Andy said that, when I said the thing about seriousness, that's dangerous. But the matter is how you understand serious. The establishment is not serious in that it's not authentic. It's duplicitous. It tells you something and it does something quite different. You know, it tells you that it's for climate change and then it tries to go against everything that it's saying in public. It tells you that it's for freedom and then it will sell your freedom into the surveillance state. It tells you that it wants to find you jobs, but the only job you'll find is stamping out basically those license plates in prison, because it's much more appealing for an unserious establishment to employ you as a prisoner than to actually train you to produce jobs that help in a solidarity economy in your neighborhood. So in that sense, one should not take the ruling class seriously or imagine that they are actual leaders of a society. They are simply the heralds of a certain class that are manipulating the rest of us into believing that they are leaders of society. So that is how I understand the idea of the lack of seriousness of the establishment. They are not serious about society. They are not serious about civilization. They are certainly serious about domination. But that doesn't interest me as a value for the planet. That is their value. It is not our value. But coming back to the idea of a leaderless society, I mean, it's okay to experiment with different forms of organization. And I think especially when the left is so weak, so detrimentally weak in an organized sense, I think it's extremely important to be capacious, to be open to other people's experimentation. Too quickly we are judgmental against each other, to our detriment. You know, how many line struggles have destroyed the American left over the last 35 years. People have got into bitter, acrimonious arguments about the very smallest thing. You know, we have a massive adversary, and yet we're unable to listen to each other. We have so much, we have like a closed mentality as far as, you know, the left tradition is concerned. At this point, the left has to be open to all experimentations because none of us has a program that is succeeding. You know, we're all trying extremely hard. We're all trying alongside each other. And I think we need to respect that. You know, we need to respect the fact that when things like Occupy arrive, those are experiments. They are not settled conversations. They haven't settled the question. They are experiments. Let the experiments flourish. Work to promote experiments. If there are new experiments, throw yourself into that. We're so far away from a punctuated breakthrough, you know, where the left is in a position of even marginal hegemony. To be so narrow-minded about how we approach politics, I think is basically our failure.
Cool. Thank you very much. All right. Yeah. We're going to continue. And we're going to start with this side, so just please introduce your name, and you have 90 seconds to speak.
I'm Susan McLucas, and since we're talking about elections, I want to bring up the fact that we ought to have instant runoff elections. There was a movement to make that happen, at least for Massachusetts. A few years ago, it sort of fell apart when it just seemed like we were so far from getting the signatures we needed that we let it go for the moment, but I hope we can get back to that. But even in the absence of having that reasonable kind of elections which gets rid of the spoiler effect, which most democracies have apparently, I got to the point where I just no longer was willing to take the lesser of two evils approach and said, no, I'm voting for Jill Stein, and that's what I did. And I think we need to build the Green Party. We need to have something on the left so that the Democrats will look and say, well, I can't get too Republican, or actually I'll just lose all those people. So we have to stand up at some point for what we believe and just say, no, go green.
All right, thank you. Okay. The microphone to the left.
Good evening. My name is Bob Funk. I'm representing Veterans for Peace. And I have more of a, thank you. I have more of a statement than I do a question, although willing in a question. My heart is warmed at seeing every last one of you here. Every last one of you are courageous. Every last one of you are beacons of light in the darkness. My question is, would you please give yourselves all a hand for being such a wonderful part of a movement where we can change this world? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ariel. I'm a French student. I would like to ask you a question. It might be an outside view, but I feel like in France, what has been considered as a very significant development during the U.S. election was the very, very high rate of intention of vote that was received by the libertarian candidates. And it was kind of a surprise because after the crisis in 2008, we would not have expected that a very strong anti-state discourse would get such a success in the US. How do you interpret it? Do you feel that it was rather the anti-war discourse which really attracted the attention of the American people, or was it the economic aspect of the discourse? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I can't answer the libertarian question. I don't know how, I mean, I know the libertarians this year won 1 million votes. The Green Party won 400,000 nationally. It's a pretty miserable set of numbers, any way you look at it. You know, if you add the two, it's less than 1.5 million compared to about, I believe it's 118 million votes cast. And 91 million people did not vote, eligible voters. So 91 million people didn't vote. 131 million people voted for, 118 million voted for the two parties, and 1.5 million people voted for the Libertarians and Greens. Whether this is an increase from previous years, I'm not that kind of sophologist. I don't keep those numbers in my head, but it's a pretty miserable situation. As you look at it. No, the issue of why one should look at the, you know, various resolutions in the states is not because those changes are going to necessarily result in anything good, but those ordinances reveal that there is a real shift in the, at least, confidence of the public. You know, those who were around in the 1980s remember how the so-called anti-abortion section rose rapidly and shut down so many conversations. You know, they produced the kind of cultural space that creates these lunatics like Akin and Murdoch and, you know, these people who don't really know what they're talking about. They don't live in today's America. You know, they don't understand the attitudes of the bulk of the population. And that's what these ordinances demonstrate, that there's a shift in confidence. People now say, no, we are for gay marriage. Now, whatever one may think about gay marriage, it demonstrates a confidence about a new social understanding, how we should live, how we should treat each other, etc. That's what's important. These changes within the structure don't necessarily transform the structure. To transform the structure is a very long road. You know, it's going to take building the confidence of the population. You know, confidence of a population is built not only through good ideas, but by demonstrating to people that those good ideas are actually practical and that they can actually take up the pressing issues of the population. You know, that is a very important task for us. And tragically, at least in economics, which I know better, tragically, too many people on the left are taking their ships into the safe harbor of Keynesianism, saying that if only we can get the government to do more deficit spending, to do more stimulus spending, everything will be okay. I don't have time to develop this, why that is a stupid idea, but essentially that is not a useful idea because it's utopian. It's not going to happen under this dispensation. This kind of class configuration is never going to allow adequate stimulus spending. It has not allowed it for 100 years. It's not going to allow it now. You need to totally transform the system in order to have a genuine popular economy. And that cannot happen now except in small pockets where people are building solidarity economies. You know, but these are at very small scales and they don't capture the bulk of our existence. You know, for instance, where I live, the bakers are creating collectives. But they will all tell you that the problem is that we have to buy our flour from King Arthur, you know, because there's no wheat grown in our area. So the wheat is grown elsewhere, it's processed by King Arthur. So they are, as it were, you know, they are at the bottom end of big corporate power. So you can build solidarity economies, but you have to transform the nature of corporate power. You cannot do one and say we've solved the problem. In that sense, what I'm trying to just get at is this is a very long road, and we have to be sober about the road we're taking. We have to understand that it is a long road, and if we understand that, we'll be patient and we'll be here for the long haul. We won't decide to give up halfway and become, you know, like Christopher Hitchens and people like that. We have to stay with this for our lives and more.
Well, just a couple of words. The first question was about voting for what we believe in. The speaker voted for Jill Stein. I did too, but that's because I'm in Massachusetts, and it's a safe state. If I'd been in Ohio, I would not have voted for Romney and Ryan. And if you just think of the arithmetic, if you're not voting, holding your nose for Obama, you're voting for Romney and Ryan. That's arithmetic. We can argue about a lot of things, but not arithmetic. So the question is, there is a question. You have to think about what you do in a swing state. And I'll repeat what I said before. My own view is that for people like you, for activists, that should take about 5 minutes. You should take 5 minutes during the whole electoral extravaganza and say, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Then you forget about it and go back to the work that has to be done. So that's what I think, it's called strategic voting. And I think it's in the world in which we now live, and that's where we have to act, in the short term, I think that's what we have to do. As for the libertarians, you have to remember that American libertarianism is a very unique phenomenon. I mean, in Europe, and in the tradition, the libertarian meant socialist. There were several wings of the socialist movement. Some of them were pro-state, some were anti-state. The anti-state sectors of the socialist movement, anarchists, anarcho-syndicalists, left Marxists like Panikok and others, they were libertarians. Here it's different. The United States is very different from similar societies. It's been a business-run society for a long time. And here what libertarian means is capitalist tyranny. If you think through the so-called libertarian programs, they, not that the people involved believe this, but just think through the consequences. They're saying, let's allow free rein to capitalist institutions, which will create the worst imaginable tyranny in the world. Now, it's true that it does appeal to an anti-state sentiment among the population, but you really have to think through what that is. And for activists, that's very important. So take say the people, I mentioned this before, I'll say it again. Take the people who say, get the government off my back. I don't want those guys interfering with me. Those same people want more spending on education, health, support for dependent women with dependent children, aid to the foreign aid, constructive foreign aid. That's what they want, but they think it's they think they're anti-state. In fact, you all recall, I'm sure, the guy who stood up at a public meeting and said, "You know, I don't want you to take my Medicare away from me." That's not to be ridiculed. That's a very common attitude. Actually, it's been pretty well studied. And it turns out that the people who are most dependent on government support are the ones who are most opposed to government support. That's an achievement of the propaganda system, just like the things I mentioned. It has to be countered. An interesting thing to think about is attitude towards taxes. That's a pretty good index of how democratic a society is. If you had a really functioning democracy, April 15th would be a day of celebration. It's a day in which we get together, put our resources towards implementing the programs that we've decided on. That's great. You know, there has to be cooperative involvement in implementing proposals. Okay, we decided on them. We thought these are the ones to do. Now we're going to help implement them. In the United States, it's a day of mourning because some alien force, which has absolutely nothing to do with you, is coming to steal your hard-earned money. Now, that's an indication of how the very concept of democracy has just been driven out of people's heads. They believe in it. They really do believe in it, most people. They say, yeah, we want to control our own fate. But the conceptions are so distorted that nothing happens. Actually, we just saw it in the last hurricane a couple days ago. You take a look at the Boston, the affluent suburbs in Boston, okay? In these suburbs, every time there's a serious storm, the people lose power, okay? What would it take to overcome that? It would take a willingness to work together to a minuscule degree to pay slightly higher taxes, which most of those people wouldn't even notice, in order to put the wires underground. But that's too much cooperation. You can't do that. And those are attitudes that we have to deal with. The activist movements are going to have to deal with those attitudes. This gets to the question of class. As you may know, in the United States, class is a dirty word. I think this is the only country in the world, maybe one of the few countries in the world, where even the Census Bureau doesn't provide data that's class-related. So when people like, say, Vicente Navarro want to study class health relations, they have to study income-race relations and then look at the correlation between race and class, and then you can get some derivative notions out. Everyone here has got to, there's two classes, either you're underclass or you're middle class, but nobody's working class. You can't be working class. You heard this all through the debates and so on. Because working class is a threatening notion. It means people who are making the society work. Now, they're not middle class, they're working people. And they have to be shafted, and nobody wants to be one of them, so we got to be middle class. So as Vijay said, there's a long road ahead, even just to dismantle misunderstandings and confusions. And I think when it's done, you find that most of the population actually pretty much agrees with you. It's just that not in the terms that you're presenting, because those have been demonized. It's like supporting welfare or supporting foreign aid. I can't do that. But we do support what they would do. You know, those are the openings that activists have to deal with, and also to provide demonstration that you can actually achieve something. So talk to serious organizers in, say, downtown Boston. They'll tell you, as others do, that a way to start organizing a community is to set up some task that can actually be achieved. So maybe you get a group of mothers together to petition the city council to put a traffic light on a street where kids cross to go to school. And if you get together, you may be able to achieve that. And that tells you, yeah, we can achieve something. And then you go on to the next thing. Actually, one of the most important aspects of the Occupy movement, in my opinion, I've often said this, is just that it brought people together in communities of mutual support. It's a very remarkable fact in the United States. It's an extremely atomized society, not by accident. A lot of work goes into creating that. And just to break out of that is very important. But again, it has to reach beyond the participants, go out into the neighborhoods, bring in other people. And those are the, that's, in my view, the long road that has to be followed. It's not going to be easy. I don't think it's impossible.
A quick question. How many of you ate something today? Can I just see a show of hands of people who ate today? Sadly, for me, what touched your lives today was a company called Monsanto. And the way I like to refer to our government now is as Monsanto are us. You know, it is my deepest wish that this company could see a different path towards organic and permaculture and all sorts of things. But currently, right now, we're in a place where I feel that our food supply and the way we eat, the way we grow food, the way we care about what we put in our mouths has been completely occupied and taken away from us. And a few weeks ago, I really had this opportunity to go see the Dalai Lama over at MIT. And they were talking about, in you know, the environmental impacts of the GMOs and the pesticides and agrobiz. And, you know, I've been working on this issue for years, for those of you who know me. And at that point in time, I made a vow that I was going to bring up this issue of Monsanto wherever I got to go to be around thinkers. I mean, I got to talk to Elizabeth Warren last week and Joe Kennedy. And I'm going to pose these questions to you as well, because I think it's something, it's an issue, a base issue, because as you saw, everybody eats. It's a base issue where we can come together in community. It's a base issue that touches workers and people who've been hurt and all kinds of things. So please just comment on this in general, how you see us making a shift. My dream is to have a meeting with spiritual leaders and great thinkers of the world like yourself and the leaders of this company and really shift our global dialogue on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so the mic to the left.
Hello, my name's Matthew. I'm with a new organization called Revolutionary Unity, and I came down from Vermont. I'm a former resident of the area, so I came down for this forum and to support E5, so thank you for coming. My question is, actually, I read an article, I have been reading periodically articles about Myanmar, and apparently Obama is planning on visiting there. Hillary Clinton visited there recently, and it seems like there's a real concerted effort to reintegrate Myanmar into the international community. And so I'm kind of curious, why are they trying to do this, Myanmar? What is the role of Myanmar? And then, and it seems that the democracy movement there is, I mean, this is my impression just from reading a few newspaper articles. This isn't like by any means like my personal pet issue. So I'm trying to understand. Like, it seems like they're really being, the democracy movement in Myanmar is being used as kind of a pawn to justify this reintegration, and there's something going on there, but I'm not sure how real it is, so could you confirm or deny my suspicions about the role of the democracy movement, and perhaps compare Myanmar to other pariah states on the U.S. list, like Cuba, which doesn't seem to get reintegrated, or Libya, which I think we thought was reintegrated and then got slaughtered. So could you perhaps make those comparisons? Thank you.
Thank you. And then the last question, last mic question of the night.
I have two questions. I have a couple of friends who are very conservative Roman Catholics, and I've just backed off from even discussing certain issues with them, as you can well imagine. I'm wondering how one can find common ground and a higher level of, not argument, but some place where you can agree with people, come to an agreement with people that are very different views, because I think this impacts, obviously, personally as well as in a larger organizations. And the other thing about about governance, I'm wondering how we can learn to be more self-governing. I don't think there's really such a thing as a leaderless society, but how can we all learn to take back our own power and really be self-governing in the best sense?
Thank you. So unfortunately, due to time, that is going to be the last mic'd question, and then we're going to pass it to the panel for reactions, thoughts, reflections.
Okay, well, since I'm closest to you, I'll start. The first question, if I understood it, had to do with paying attention to significant intellectuals and thinkers and so on. I may have a somewhat biased view about this because of my own experience. For better or worse, that's where I've been living for all my life, in elite intellectual circles, you know, Harvard, Oxford, equivalents, the rest of the world. Didn't leave me with a lot of respect for intellectuals, I have to say. I think, by and large, they're the most indoctrinated and obedient part of the population. There are exceptions. You know, there's a fringe of exceptions. But whether it's intellectuals or carpenters or, anybody else, you should listen to what they have to say. And if it makes sense, okay. I'll agree with it. If it doesn't make sense, don't. Like, I wouldn't want you to just, you know, I'm supposed to be an intellectual, but I wouldn't want you to agree with what I say because I have, you know, so many degrees or something. Does it make any sense? And that's for you to decide. And I must say that in my own experience, some of the most lively intellectual communities I've ever been in were people had almost no education, formal education, but were educated, self-educated. They'd learned about the world and so on, and those are people who were influential in my life, and I see them all over, you know. But that's for you to, you know, I think it's ultimately your decision as to how to evaluate what you hear and say. On Iran and sanctions, I'd like to pick up from what Vijay said, which I agree with as far as it goes, but I think you can go farther. He pointed out that one of the issues, that there's an issue that's kind of marginalized, namely that the intelligence agencies have made it quite clear, in fact, they say with high confidence, we don't know whether Iran is pursuing what's called nuclear capability, the capability to develop nuclear weapons. But there are two further questions that ought to be asked that, in my view, are more significant. First of all, what's the threat if they do develop nuclear capability? And second, what can we do about it? Now, there happen to be very simple answers to those two questions. We can get an answer to what the threat would be from the highest source, the most authoritative source, the U.S. intelligence and the Pentagon. Every year, they provide an analysis to Congress of the global security situation. It's public. Now, it's not reported, but you can find it. It's public. It's on the internet. Dissidents like me write about it and so on, so you can find it. And what they say is pretty interesting. They say Iran has limited capacity to deploy force. It has very low military spending, even by the standards of the region. I mean, compared with us, it's non-existent. They say they have a military a strategic doctrine. The doctrine is to deter invasion. So they want to be able to deter invasion long enough for diplomacy to set in. And then they say that if they're developing a nuclear capability, which they don't know, it would be part of their deterrent strategy. Okay, so that's the threat. And that's understandable. If your intention is to be able to use force and violence freely all over the world, then if anyone has a deterrent capacity, they're a threat. It's worth knowing that. It's worth, but try to find it somewhere. It's right there, you know. Like I say, you can look it up. It's not secret, but try to find some discussion of it. That's even less than what you were talking about. Now, there's another point which is extremely important for activists. Let's assume there's some kind of threat, which incidentally is seen almost entirely in the West. The non-aligned movement doesn't see it. The Arab world doesn't see it. It's basically the U.S. and its allies, they see it. They say it's the greatest threat in the world. All right, let's agree, it's a threat. What can you do about it? There's a very simple answer. Work to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Now that happens to have overwhelming international support, virtually unanimous, including the non-aligned movement, Iran, the movement's been led by Egypt for 17 years, keeps coming up at the UN, and that would make a lot of sense. You know, it doesn't end everything, but it's a way to mitigate, maybe end whatever threat there might be. So why doesn't it happen? Because of the United States. The United States refuses to permit it, and that includes Obama. Obama's official position is, yeah, it's a terrific idea, but we can't do it now, and we can't, and Israel has to be excluded. Okay, end of nuclear weapons-free zone. There happens to be a conference coming up, an international conference in Helsinki, which is going to, it's the latest of a series of international conferences, UN-sponsored, to deal with this question. Have you seen a word about it in the press? I've looked. I mean, the only things I can find are what I write, a couple other people write, but and they're not in the press. You know, you can find them. But it's totally blanked out. That's coming up in a couple of months. That's the concrete, straightforward, simple way to deal with whatever threat you think this is. Now, unless there's substantial public pressure, the U.S. isn't going to change its position. And there can't be public pressure unless people at least know about it. And here the free press has carried out a very impressive service. As far as I can tell, they've blanked this out with 100% efficiency. That's pretty impressive in a free society where the government isn't forcing you to do anything. Actually, you can find a little about it in the international press, but here, essentially nothing. And that's pretty critical. If you think there's a threat, whatever it may be, there's a very substantive way to approach lessening it, maybe ending it, but you got to know about it first. And those are things for activists to do. Obama and the democracy movements and Myanmar and so on. It's extremely important to understand that elite sectors, powerful sectors, are strongly opposed to democracy, and for very elementary reasons, that democracy would weaken their power. So say, take the Arab Spring. The U.S. and its allies are strongly opposed to democracy in the Arab world, and for very good reasons, which also don't get reported. In a democracy, public opinion has an influence on policy. That's what democracy is. So what's public opinion in the Arab world? Well, it happens to be very well studied by the leading U.S. polling agencies. They see a threat in the world, serious threat, the United States and Israel. That's the top threat. They don't like Iran. This goes way back to conflicts long and long ago. So they don't like Iran, but they don't think it's a threat. In that, they join the non-aligned movement, most of the world, and in fact, everyone outside the West. In fact, opposition to U.S. policy is so strong that on some polls and in some places, like Egypt, a majority has actually felt the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons. Well, does the United States want those attitudes to be translated into policy? Take 2 seconds to give the answer, and you can see why the United States is strongly opposed to democracy in the Arab world. Now, if you read the newspapers, you see a lot of euphoria about the fact that the Arabs support us in Iran. But notice who they're quoting. Mm-hmm. They're quoting the dictators. The dictators at least say that they support us in Iran. And if you really hate democracy and have total contempt for it, then if the dictators support you and the population's totally against it, they support us. That's us. That's our intellectual elites, to get back to the first question. And it's the same across the board. And it's perfectly understandable. They don't want democracy here either. And no time to, with, we could, if there were time, could go into the details. But let me just, I happen to have just come back a couple of days ago from a place that gives a dramatic illustration of elite and intellectual attitudes towards democracy, namely Gaza. Gaza is under very harsh attack constantly. And the reason is they committed 2 crimes, very serious crimes. The first crime was in January 2006. There was a free election, and they voted the wrong way. And instantly, the U.S., Israel, European Union, timidly following along the way they always do, imposed very harsh sanctions. That was the first crime. The second one was even worse. The United States immediately put into operation standard operating procedure when a population is so ridiculous as to vote the wrong way in a free election. They try to organize a military coup to overthrow the government. I mean, there's so many examples of this that I won't insult you by listing them. It's standard. So that's exactly what the U.S. did. Started to organize a military coup. Well, it was preempted and beaten back. And that's a really serious crime. I mean, it's bad enough to vote the wrong way in a free election, But to block a U.S. effort to violently overturn the elected government, I mean, by now, you know, we're really talking serious crimes. And in fact, the sanctions and the siege and the violent attacks and so on escalated very sharply at that point. Well, that tells you what elite attitudes are towards free elections. And it's understandable, and you find it everywhere, and it goes way back, and it's not just the United States. And I think that's the kind of thing you ought to think through. It's not that there's any shortage of examples, and they're very dramatic. There was an interesting question at the end about common ground, especially with Catholics, I think, and how you can find it with people. Actually, that's something I've lived with for a long time, so I'll just tell you my own experience. I grew up as a kid in a, we were the only Jewish family in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, which was violently anti-Semitic. I mean, I grew up with a visceral fear of Catholics. It took years. I mean, I at some point realized this is ridiculous, but after you've been running away from these Irish kids for a while, it's kind of built in. In 1962, something extremely important happened in the Catholic Church, dramatic. The Vatican II, I'm referring to, Pope John the 23rd tried to reverse 16 centuries of church doctrine and get back to the Gospels. The first couple of centuries of Christian, it wasn't called Catholic then, of Christian history, Christians were persecuted. Why? Because they were committed to the Gospels, which is a radical pacifist text. I mean, if you actually read it instead of just intoning the words, it's radical pacifist. Well, that doesn't work. In 315, 4th century, the Roman Empire decided to adopt Christianity as the church of the Roman Empire. And the cross, which was the symbol of the suffering of the poor and the persecuted, found its way to the shield of the Roman legions. And at that point, I'm quoting a famous historian of Christianity now, Hans Kuhn. At that point, the church of the persecuted became the church of the persecutors. And it pretty much remained that way until 1962, when John the 23rd wanted to try to shift it back. And that had effects, a lot of effects, which we all ought to know about, including how you find common ground. What happened is, particularly in Latin America, but also here to an extent, priests, nuns, lay people went out to poor sections and to the countryside and tried to organize communities where people would read the Gospels, actually read them, you know, not intone them the way we intone, you know, the Declaration of Independence, but read it, see what it actually says. And it was effective. And the idea was to get them to organized to try to deal with the horrors of their own lives in U.S.-supported dictatorships. Well, a number of things happened. Actually, for me personally, you know, I wouldn't say that I actually felt, look, I can convert to Catholicism at this point. But when I was, say, visiting Nicaragua, as I did in the 80s, I'd stay in the Jesuit house. These are the guys who were chasing me in the 1930s. And it was easy to find common ground with them because we agreed on a lot of things, not on everything, but there was a lot of common ground. Well, something happened. The U.S. went to war against the Catholic Church. That's not an exaggeration. You take a look at the next, at what followed, lots of religious martyrs, Archbishop assassinated while reading Mass, six leading Jesuit intellectuals had their heads blown off. The Vatican helped. And it's not my opinion. If you take a look at the School of the Americas, famous School of the Americas, which trains Latin American killers, they have talking points, advertising points. One of them is the U.S. Army helped defeat liberation theology. Okay, that's true. It wasn't very pretty, but they did. It hasn't worked everywhere, but it's worked pretty well in elite circles. So, for example, on the anniversary of Archbishop Romero's assassination, in Boston, in this area, there were commemorations in poor areas in Jamaica Plain, for instance. There wasn't any in Harvard Square, where they never heard of it, you know. So there are ways to find common ground, I think. Just have to search for them.
Thank you. So this conversation has to stop at this moment, but take a look around, notice the people who are here. If you want to continue conversations after we leave this space, please do. At this moment in time, we would like us to all the members, organizing committee in terms of E5, if you can please stand up. Round of applause. Round of applause to all our panelists. And a round of applause to all of you who made this happen today.
Thank you so much, and have a great night.